big fat deferred comp provision, which was the best in the state. So severance pay, in other words, best in the state from then until we just recently, the local gave some of it back because it became really hard to justify.
It's been in there for 20 plus years.
Basically what it is a sick leave conversion. You get 15 sick days a year. In most districts, well, especially then, nearly all districts, you had a cap on how many you could accumulate, and you would convert them. State law, the minimum is, unless you bargain otherwise, 25% of the total with whatever cap you get paid, you know, at retirement. We bargained unlimited accumulation and a 50% conversion. It's unheard of at the time. Boy, does it get expensive, you know, down the road. But after, you know, I was in office 20 years, 21 years, we met or exceeded the cost of living every single year. At some point, nobody's around that, you know, when you justified that big deferred comp thing, because we hadn't had, you know, under association bargaining, high inflation 70s, there were years with no raises, and 3% was a big raise, you know, I think 3.5 might have been 1.4 in the whole 70s. Maybe a 3.5 and the rest, you know, 3 or below. So you could justify, you know, this deferred comp. Can't pay you now, pay you later, but after 20 years of getting steady raises, it's harder to justify. Mm-hmm. Writing those big, you know, checks, and they become, press starts talking about them. And, you know,
right.
Superintendent got what? Oh, do the teachers get that too? And, you know. So they did give some ground in the last contract.
But this is not bad for a first contract after a 4-week strike.
Yes and no. I mean, we certainly played it up, the good parts of it. I think in reality, we sort of fought them to a bloody draw. It was really a good settlement given the actual strength that we had and the number of people we actually had out. That's for sure. And then in light of, you know, the president panicking at the end and undercutting Bates, you know, Bates has nerves of steel. If the president hadn't kind of interfered and gone around him, I think we might have done a little better. But, and then there was the militant wing. This is the probably an untold story for the most part. I can give you plenty of collaborators. We were conspiring, and we let Bates in on the conspiracy. We're here if you need us. Here's what we got planned. And we were planning a sit-down occupation of the education center. Remember, this is the 60s generation. And we had, I don't remember now, geez, it was hundreds, at least a couple hundred people signed up to do this. Because we could tell we were at the break point, that we were, you know, something, we were going to have to find a settlement because we were going to be able to keep people out. Oh, by the way, along the way, they got injunctions. Mm. They ordered us all back, court ordered us all back to work. Everybody proudly, you know, framed their injunctions or tore them up or burned them or whatever, you know. That did not cause a ripple. Some got worn down economically, or they didn't think we were winning, and hardly anybody was out at their school. But it wasn't because of the legal threats. That did not. The day after that, you know, we didn't see any big attrition.
Basically, you can't fire us all type mentality.
Right.
Were any fines levied on them?
They never did end up fining us as individuals. I'm trying to remember if they fined officers of the union. I can't remember. They might have. And of course, it may have helped that we had some political support. Even once it was over, like, okay, let's have you. We had a no retaliation clause, which they didn't honor. That's another story. But anyway, the point is that everybody knew that this has got to get settled, you know, pretty soon here. But our thought was that we got to ratchet up the pressure one more time, real quick, before we maximize our leverage to get best settlement. And I don't know in retrospect whether this was a good idea. It seemed like a real good idea at the time, and we could have done it. And we're already illegal, so who cares? So we're gonna occupy the lobby of the Ed Center, sit down, you know, just stay. And what are they gonna do? You let them put us all in jail. You know, let them drag us off, fill up the jails. Fine. Then that becomes the problem. The problem is we always got school teachers in jail. What are we gonna do? And the point was to force a more of a crisis. I think given that our tactics were pretty much traditional militant tactics at the time, I don't think we could have lost anything. We probably would have gained by taking it just one step further, you know, totally nonviolent sit-in approach. But Bates seemed to be game, but, you know, the president panicked at this thought, at the thought of, then people dragged, some of the political and business leaders dragged him off into back rooms and threatened and cajoled and intimidated. Whatever, we settled. So, you know, and then I got up actually representing at the ratification meeting. Oh, I know. I'm sorry. The other part that's important, though, is that the settlement I can be sort of philosophical about it now, but at the time we were really pissed off because not only did we feel they caved a little too soon, but the settlement was made agreed to by the bargaining team in a meeting in a hotel room, and a couple of us didn't get told where it was. At least that was our perception. It wasn't just me. It was two older guys, well, including the past president that went to jail, and another one of my mentors, a charter member of the local. We were sort of the militant faction on the bargaining team, three out of the nine. I know a couple that were real flaky, and most of them were just solid in the middle. Some of them got real shaky and panicky like the president did, or they took his example. But anyway, three of us were ready to hold out, and we somehow didn't get notified exactly where. I mean, I'm wandering around the damn hotel lobby, you know, trying to find the damn meeting. So that was left a bad taste, obviously. So I did get up, even though I was on the team, got up and spoke against the ratification. And we had, our 200 militants kind of voted against it. But, you know, we moved on. I guess in some ways it did. It probably actually created then the foundation for us forming a caucus and, you know, contesting the leadership a couple years later. But meantime, we weren't overtly oppositional, at least for a while. Sharon Cole had already moved on by then. Lynn Marmer became the second vice president and director of organization, but after a year, maybe even less than a year, she decided to go back to school. Is that when she got married and moved to Baltimore? Anyway, she left for a while later, came back. So having been a pretty good area coordinator and shown a lot of membership growth and organizational skills in those schools, got tapped for that job. Well, this is not only the key, at least, from the way the local had functioned up to then, this was the key job other than the president. Certainly was the one that you had your fingers on the organizational apparatus. It's definitely the place to be if you want to run for president, actually. So that was in 78. So this is a pretty rapid, series of developments. And then in with the election of 79 is when kind of the mostly middle school based younger, more militant folks began to talk and began to talk about actually running a slate and, forming a caucus. And Cincinnati we didn't end up, I think for us at least, it was the right thing. We didn't end up with sort of permanent caucuses. Caucuses would form, really around a slate, more of a campaign committee almost, and then kind of dissipate. And I always, the years I was president, I always debated with myself and my closest associates and advisors, should we have a more permanent caucus to, advance a program and really, kind of have more of a cohesive philosophy of where we were trying to lead the union, but it just wasn't part of the culture. It never really kind of made up my mind, I suppose. We made a couple of attempts, but I think it was more of a freewheeling democratic local. His idea of democracy was pretty rooted in like monthly membership meetings are still sacred. Once along the way, I tried to get him to consider a rep assembly. Went over like bomb totally, And I, fairly strong leader by that point. No, they weren't buying that. It was just alien to the traditions and
organization. That's interesting. A conservative Cincinnati is more, and the membership is more open to an open democracy of the town hall meeting type thing.
Well, I think it was the kind of activist culture that built the union. Okay. It wasn't necessarily typical of Cincinnati, characteristic of Cincinnati that.
So it's
still carries over. Yeah. Anyway, so we never had permanent caucus, but we did form, a slate and a committee to, which we called CFT, New Directions, and it was like a lot of maneuvering and who's going to run for what. So I didn't like announce I was running for president until fairly late in the game. But by that, the president certainly was on notice that there was dissent and some dissatisfaction, and he, plus had served 10 years through three bargaining elections and first contract and strike, so he had every reason to maybe also be a little worn out. I don't know, not trying to speak for him, but he decided not to run. But his followers, did their best to put together a slate, and it was I won the presidency. It was a mixed slate, you know, that got elected. But we managed to work together fairly well,
mm-hmm.
I think, in that first term. But things got more polarized by toward the end of that term. He decided to make a comeback, sensing whatever that there was enough division, the moment might be ripe, and he, you know, put together another slate of, and I was somewhat at a disadvantage because he had really well-known names. He had the folks who'd been active during the long years of exile, you know, and just were very well-known as leaders of the union. And I had pretty much, you know, a slate of young Turks, including some of the people who elected from the other slate in 79 had faded away, had not stuck around. So I filled those vacancies and pretty much with, you know, more of the young Turks. So we had a lopsided situation in terms of the stature of candidates, I suppose, other than the, I don't know what my stature was by then, but other than the president.
But your first year of president, let's go back to that.
Take a bathroom break?
Sure. Quick. Sure. Okay, we're back recording. Back to your first presidency. What were some of your goals to try to build a better union?
Well, the most urgent problem was, you know, by this time, we're in the third year of this of our first contract. We got a 6% raise after a month on strike, and no raise in 78 or 79. So we've gone 2 years with no raise.
Mm-hmm.
So had everybody else in the district. The district's financial crisis had significantly worsened by then because they still hadn't been able to pass a levy. They got a string of defeated levies.
It's because of this law you were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
The
levies we needed to pass, especially because of that law, we couldn't pass because of too much strife, you know, in the city, I think. And because people used to passing levies, but not as often as they were now going to be needed, you know. So they really were, by 79, they were pretty broke. There had been a lot of cuts. And of course, the other thing is they kept saying to people, they made huge tactical blunders. They kept saying to the public every time there was a levy, this is do or die. If we don't pass this, we don't know what we're going to do. We might not be able to keep the doors open, blah, blah, blah. Well, then they would make cuts. So the quality of the program is diminishing, you know, steadily, and the public doesn't believe them anymore. You know, yeah, right, they got a whole bunch of money and they'll find a way, you know, just keep saying no, because they always manage to keep going. So credibility is a big issue. So somehow we had to save the district from itself, as well as get our members a raise. And the union, you know, during its first contract is still at risk of getting voted back out, because by now our credit, we took them out on strike for a month. Our credibility is, you know, suffering because we couldn't deliver on either of the two reopeners. And you know, no question, there was certainly a possibility the association could make a comeback at the next open period. So it called for fairly bold, you know, tactics and strategies, and I had, you know, run on some of those, including a lot more emphasis on labor solidarity, because it really wasn't a very cohesive, you know, approach or unified approach. And on economics, at least, everybody was in the same boat. Nobody had a raise, and everybody had seen significant cuts. So I had to move pretty quickly, you know, getting elected in May, and with the overall contract expiring in December. Now, the other thing that's going on at the time is talk of merger. The main reason that talk of merger at the local level was alive is because our president kept fostering it. And some of us thought this was a real mistake. It was one of the things we didn't like about his leadership, because it was a false hope. From what I could scope out at the national level, there were some real huge impediments. Anyway, I thought they were fucking with us. I thought mm-hmm. they weren't really serious. I thought they were plotting, you know, to make a comeback. But also that even if they were serious, that the impediments at the national level on the NEA side were pretty, you know, formidable, and that they couldn't deliver, you know, even if they were sincere. But it was, meanwhile, that talk, and it's not like that was a crazy thing to think about, it just was a bad calculation that it was doable, because you probably have a third of the teachers in neither organization at this point. And when I took office, we were claiming 1,700 members, something like that, 1,800 members. We claimed something, you know, I think we were claiming around 56. I remember that number for some reason, or, you know, somewhere in the upper 50s percentile of membership. We, you know, and the books were in, you know, shambles. When we, to the best of our ability, cleaned it up, we had under 1,500 members. We had, you know, this was the time there was like probably 4,000 teachers then. We had under 1,500 members. So we did not have 50% membership even. So we had to, you know, build membership. We had to try to rally people behind the CFT. We had to deliver on the next contract, especially on money in a very tough environment. We had to put this merger thing to bed. I mean, that was real clear to me. And I think, you know, I was probably getting pretty good. I think I was getting, not dictates, but pretty good advice probably from AFT, you know, bouncing off people up there that this wasn't going to get us anywhere. We needed to get people behind, to rally behind the CFT as the bargaining agent and not hold out this illusion that all our problems are going to be solved if we merge. So I just felt like something dramatic had to be done to bring that to a close. So there had been on and off some, you know, conversations. So I invited them to, you know, have merger discussions, and had my team, you know, prepped, and we walked in with a full, you know, four-way NYSET style merger. Mm-hmm. Everybody's a member of everything. There's one local, you know, is affiliated all with everybody. Had it written out in outline form, constitution to be worked out later, signed it, handed it across the table. And they go, we have to consult. So I said, fine, we understand, you have to consult with your members and your national folks, so let's meet in a week. So, you know, we put out a big flyer. CFT offers full merger, you know. Because the whole point is winning the hearts and minds out there that, you know, either we're going to do this or we're going to stop, you know, holding on to this illusion that's holding us up from real organizing. And I don't know, they probably knew what we were doing, but they didn't know what else to do. So we meet again a week later. They can't do that.
Right.
Then consistent with NEA bylaws or blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So this time we had an LA-type merger. Now, this is after I spent a lot of time on the phone, because this is a calculated risk now. So I spent a lot of time on the phone with Kugler at the time. Was it Kugler or was it Chuck? No, it wasn't. It was Chuck Richards at the time. Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out, you know, exactly what their parameters were and take our best guess, at least, at what the NEA would or wouldn't allow. And so I came to the conclusion, although it was not totally guaranteed, that they wouldn't let them do an LA thing either. You know, I'm talking about the LA thing, right? Where you have a new organization, you have still have technically an AFT and NEA local underneath that, but for the purpose of affiliation with their respective bodies, but there's one, you know, local. So this was really the calculated risk that they wouldn't be able to do that either. So when they rejected the full merger, we had another agreement written up saying, you know, we'd do it basically LA style, sign that, hand it across the table. Well, I mean, one thing I proved is that they were just fucking with us all. They were just taking advantage of our former president, who was, you know, looking for some quick strike to avoid having to really organize, you know, some quick, you know, stroke, in other words, to pull all this together and gain lots more leverage. And the bluff had to be called, so they couldn't sign that either, it turns out. So our next flyer was out the next day, blazing headline, NEA, you know, kills merger in Cincinnati. And I was careful not to blame the local people, I believe they were sincere, blah, 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 but their national organization will not allow it. We've now found that out. They wouldn't allow version A, they wouldn't allow version B. It's over, you know, and actually really did put it to bed. I really did. And in fact, not only that, well, the rest of the story, but after we got a contract and all that, but the next open period for a representation challenge, they didn't even mount a challenge, or if they did, they didn't even get the 30% signatures needed to trigger an election.
So the CFT is finally solidified. within Cincinnati.
Well, but I mean, not this was just one of the preconditions, was getting this merger thing out of the way. Then we had to get a contract that would restore our credibility. So what we did is, and we knew we had to pass a levy to get any kind of a financial settlement that was any good. But we also knew we couldn't wait. And we were saying we're not going to wait for a raise until a levy passes. But actually, the first next obstacle after getting the merger thing out of the way was saving the board from itself by ending the crying wolf approach that they had, where they had painted themselves into a corner by keep saying they were going to have to close, or we're going to do something, if you don't pass this levy, then they don't. So we made a demand on them that when the money runs out, you close the schools. Stop crying wolf. You sold your public guarantees before, it's time to do it. We should not, now we didn't put it, in public terms, we put it in, no more cuts. We can't cut the quality of the program anymore. It would be better to simply close the doors for the rest of the year when the money runs out. The money was projected to run out in mid-November. So you'd be talking about, I don't know what, 6 weeks or something. Because we were then on a calendar year, fiscal year. Now it's on a school academic year. And you couldn't run a deficit. Still can't. But at that time, you could close schools. You literally had, the board had the option of closing schools if they ran out of money. And it had already been done, Cleveland and Toledo and some other places. There was Ohio was on the map in the worst way nationally for its, schools literally, school funding system was so screwed up that school districts were closing. So we were out openly, advocating no more cuts, draw the line in the sand, stop crying wolf, be better to close the schools and make more cuts. And by the way, it might convince the public you really do need the levy, So that was our demand. The contract's going to run out in December. This is October, and we're agitating around, what we got to do to sort of set the stage to get a decent contract, set the stage to pass a levy. So we had a mass meeting early in the morning, and I had to do the association thing one more time, because we had a mass meeting to decide what to do. What we're going to, this is actually a tactic that the union had already had done a number of times. So the CTA, 6 a.m. meetings where we might not go to school, you don't know. We might just decide to strike. That was kind of an old play. We weren't really threatening that day, but we were keeping some mystery. We're going to call me and decide what we're going to do about this crisis and what we're going to do about the contract coming up. It's all, only October. Contract hasn't expired. Doesn't expire until end of December. So we put a proposition on the floor that we close, that we go on strike for a day, October 26th, and we have a march. We do a big march to dramatize the need to close the schools, pass a levy, and give us teachers need catch up raises, and we call on the board further to close the schools that day, right? And just don't pretend you can keep schools open without us, because no union had ever closed the schools through job action up to that point. Neither the Federation nor the Association had ever gotten them to just, call it, we can't stay open. They always, of course, had skeleton staff or whatever, but they wouldn't close. So we demanded that they close schools that day and then close schools in mid-November when the money ran out. And it was also designed to send a message that you better be damn serious when you come to the bargaining table. But we could do this because there's no bargaining law. We can't strike legally, but what are they going to do about it? And there's no framework for the bargaining process. So we did, in fact, do that. They acceded to our demands before the day came. They really saw finally a train coming. And I'm skipping all the organizing we did to get people behind us, but obviously a lot. And they felt that roar, coming out of the schools. The principals are reporting out. They're all going to the march. We actually got a permit to march in the streets at rush hour. You would never get that permit today, nor would we want to do that today and piss off the public. But different time, different set of issues, different mentality on the union's part. But at that point, you just need to have everybody get loud and clear. We ain't putting up with this shit no more, and this has to come to a crisis. So about a week before the day, and of course we gave ourselves like 2 weeks between when we voted and when we're going to go do it, we set October 26th as the date. So they saw it coming. They voted to close the schools on October 26th and join the march because it really is about the lack of state funding, which was part of the problem. And we gave the state some of our flack too. They were trying, in other words, deflect it from them to the state, and they were going to march with us. And they did, in fact, vote to close the schools with the money. In other words, they basically agreed to our strategy, and they were hanging by a hair. The board was split on whether to finally close the schools or whether to make more cuts. And some saying it's irresponsible to close and keep kids out of school. So we pushed them over the edge on that. The march was pretty incredible. It was the largest labor march, from what I could tell from the newspaper archives and from talking to the old hands in the labor movement, it was the largest labor march in Cincinnati, at least since the early 50s. Mm-hmm. We had the labor council, head with us in the front of the march, and some other union leaders, some community leaders, but mostly labor. And we blocked traffic for, miles and miles and miles in every direction because it was rush hour and they couldn't get into downtown. We marched right through downtown.
You could not do that today.
No, and people were pissed. They were honking at us. And some people were honking in sympathy, but most not, and gesturing and cursing and stuff. But we got their attention, yeah. Something had to give. And so then we come back, and then a few weeks later, schools close. We get our people all ready to sign up for unemployment. The board pulls a fast one. Somehow or other, I don't know, I remember the details of this. So some maneuver that they pulled, whereby we wouldn't get the full unemployment we were entitled to. We sued on that. But in the end, we got, I think we were closed 3 weeks. It was 1 week that was in question. We got some unemployment. You'll have to check me on that.
Okay.
But we got some unemployment, but there was a dispute about how much. And then they figured out also that they could reopen the schools in mid-December because they wouldn't have to pay people until January because of the way the pay periods ran. So we were only closed 3 weeks, which was fine. And that was enough that, following June, they passed the levy. Right. But that's what it was. It was mostly the school closing, somewhat the march and the militancy. Meantime, we got to go to the table. Then we start negotiations in December. And there's no, still levy, of course, hasn't passed yet. So the other maneuver we had been working on was with city council. We had some friends on city council, including Jared Springer, who was the up-and-coming, at that point, not yet mayor. We also had a Republican friend, kind of wacky guy named DeCourcy. And the two of them got together. And city council has no jurisdiction over the schools, fully separate. Governmental entities in Ohio, other than Cleveland, which was put in because the mayoral control was put in just recent years because it was such a disaster, but constitutionally there's no connection. So they have no financial obligation and no even right to give money to schools if they want to, but we didn't let that stand in the way. So we start working up some support over there to be our ace in the hole in the end. But meanwhile, we go to the table and say, we need real raises, we need catch-up raises. The march, the amount of people that were left their schools in March, the message was pretty strong. They better be serious, and we were prepared to strike and made no bones about it. And that was almost a miracle because after the 77 strike, so divisive, so long, gains, modest, the strike reluctance was pretty damn high. But we had gotten them, pretty whipped up. So long story short. They knew we were serious, and then we had to be real creative, and they had to be real creative about getting around the law, because the law also, the other impediment is the law says you can't grant raises, bargained or otherwise, without certifying. The treasurer and the superintendent have to sign certificates under various penalties, they are lying, that they have the money to pay it. I mean, simplifying somewhat. And they have to be able to pay the raises and operate schools, kind of roughly comparable to the program that they're running now for the remainder of the current fiscal year and the following year. Now, they've made that even worse today, but at the time, that was it. Remainder of the current year and the following year. Well, that meant, in theory, we had our lawyers working on this, and they were motivated enough now on the inside table to start to try to be creative. When it gets to December, you've got a few days left in the current fiscal year, and you've got to get through one more year. So if nothing else, if they were convinced that they had to give raises, the teacher attrition rates were massive, by the way, during this period, including, they're all during the year people are leaving. It's not at the end, just at the end. And they knew they had a problem for that respect as well as the militancy. So in theory, you could say, okay, it's the end of 79, is almost over, we got to get through 80, we can't certify we can afford raises in 80, but effective, you know, January 1, 81, we can grant whatever raises we want. It doesn't mean we have the money to pay them, nor do we have to certify we have the money to pay them. And if we don't have the money to pay them and keep the doors open, then what happens in 81 is we have to go to the state loan fund. Mm-hmm. At that time, you had an option of closing schools or going to the state loan fund. And if you went to the state loan fund, they would have to loan you enough money to cover your contractual obligations as well as maintain operations. But, I mean, there's a price to be paid for that. The state loan fund was really kind of like being a third world country in the clutches of the IMF. You have to pay the loan back over a pretty short period of time, and you have to make cuts along the way to do that. So first you get to take away, you know, meat from the peasants, and then milk, and then bread, you know, as you pay back your IMF loan. It was ugly, but it was in the short term a way of getting, you know, the raises to stabilize the workforce and stabilize the district, and while you try to pass another levy. So you could sign such a thing, and it would be legal, and it would be binding, and the state would have to cover your vet, you know, at least in the short term, if you didn't pass a levy in between. So we began to talk about, in other words, this kind of an arrangement, and the question became, what are the numbers? And the bigger, thornier issue even was, what do you do in the short term? What do you do for 1980? We're not going a third year without a raise. We want to be clear, we're not doing it. We're going straight. Well, that's where the council thing came in. Somehow or other, we found, God, I don't even remember what the legal, why we decided this was legal, but where they claimed they didn't have any money, and couldn't legally pay anything in the first year unless it was contingent on, you know, passing a levy. We got the council to pass a resolution guaranteeing the school board up to $5 million if needed to fund the contract in the first year. Again, with no structural connection between the city and the schools, just because we had enough, you know, political friends on council. Huh. And we've been playing the council races, you know, for many years, so it's when that long-term, even at low level of political action, you know, pays off. So that kind of put them in the corner. When it got down to the only issue is what to do about the first year, and then we sprung our city council surprise, and, you know, that kind of made them have to come and agree to something in the first year. Bottom line, we got 5.3% guaranteed in the first year, paid up front. We got another 10% contingent on the passage of the levy. It was to be on the ballot in June. We got, in 81, a guaranteed, levy or no levy, 12.5%. And what the hell was in the third year? I think it was 8. And we also got bonuses, you know, for making up for the previous 2 years. We got, you know, two one-time payments. Along the way, as we were getting close to these numbers, but there wasn't anything, it was very little in the first year, you know, we would caucus, and I had, I didn't have a Nat rep, but I had John Creator, who's one of our veteran OFT staff reps with us, and then we did have something from AFT. Who was it? I can't remember. It wasn't like they were, I was being the chief negotiator, but anyway, you know, we would caucus, and we'd go, shit, look at all this money. Mm-hmm. God damn, we're like,
that's why I'm looking at the numbers.
We can't believe it. And we would come back, they'd come back, and we'd go, this just sucks. You can't possibly recommend. We were pretty good at the traditional bargaining game. The first year's got to get better, especially or we're taking a while. And now it's getting to December 31st. So if we don't ink something, then mid, you know, 12:01 a.m., the board's got to certify they can afford whatever it is for not all of 80 and all of 81, you know, two full years. So you're putting off any big money at least another year. So the pressure's on everybody. It's, you know, it's really a game of nerves at that point. But in the end, we did get an agreement. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a major step, though. We're at the table with all the unions. We, along the way, back in the fall, prior to the March, actually, part of the October 26 one-day strike in March, which, by the way, the school board closed, so we did get to make up that day, make up the pay. We formed a united bargaining council with all the unions. That was a key meeting. Somebody had campaigned on, you know, earlier in 79 and was able to put together. So we're all there together at the table.
AFSCME, Teamsters, building.
Only time that worked. But it worked because we were all really in the same boat. And we were putting off, essentially what we were doing is putting off the non-economics. This was going to be an economic agreement for 3 years with a reopener on the non-economic issues. I think it was after the levy vote, or maybe it was right away. We had to get the money done. We knew that by December 31st. Everybody understood that. So since it was only money, it was all common issues, it was pretty hard to, it was easier at least to stay on track. But, you know, I was the chief spokesperson, chief negotiator, when the leaders of the other unions were like, you know, twice my age. And that was kind of interesting and delicate. But I don't know, it worked. They were good guys, and they, you know, they seemed to respect what I was doing. But I'm talking about guys who had built, you know, their unions. Like Al Van Hagen was like legendary, the AFSCME leader for the city workers as well, and county workers as well as the schools. Stan Inman, who was the strongest ally we ever had for the, was operating engineers. And that was before a lot of the heating and air conditioning was mechanized, so these plant operators could really shut the thing down all by themselves. And there was the Building Trades Council representing maybe 100 tradespeople that worked for the district at the time. And at that time, the secretaries had an association, but it wasn't really a union, so they were the only ones that weren't at the table. And anyway, so we hung tough and we hung together and we got this massive agreement. I'm trying to remember. I used to be able to rattle these numbers off, but over 3 years, we got 27.5% increase on the base over the 3 years. The levy did pass, so we got the 10%. We actually got 15.3% in the first year. The 5.3% was guaranteed. The 10% was contingent on the levy. And what was the bonuses? 27.5% was raises. I think it was 12% in bonuses.
I saw that it was 38% total.
Okay.
For that whole
year. All right, that sounds right. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was tumultuous and exhilarating, you know, the first 8 months in office.
What a ride. Are you still teaching at this time?
No. Okay. Our local constitution actually says the president's full-time position.
Okay.
So I came out of the classroom pretty much right away in May of 79.
Cool. So that was your first 8 months, and that was your first, pretty much first year presidency.
Yeah. And we had to work hard, of course, to pass the levy, but I think the school closing really...
Right. So let's go into your next bargaining.
Well, then we had this long drawn out non-economic bargaining, and we did get some things. We got a layoff procedure. The contract, neither our first contract nor the three contracts the CTA had bargained ever had a layoff procedure, which was pretty basic. Mm-hmm. But the board apparently really resisted that. Now, interestingly, what it was, what we ended up doing, really, was pretty much putting their existing policy into the contract initially. And at the time, we thought it was way less than we wanted, but at least it was enforceable. You know, what it says, what the criteria are, and, you know, you have to follow it and grieve it. In the end, in retrospect, years later, we figured, you know, we decided, no, it's not so. We tightened it up here and there, but basic outline of it is still what it was, and it ain't so bad, you know. Mm-hmm. When I say what I'm really talking about is the role of seniority. You know, of course, we were looking at the flagship contracts as we formulated our demands, you know, from the first contract, you know, in 77 to later ones. And I remember at the time, to me at least, the premier contract was Philly. Philly had the most detail on everything from transfer and assignment to class size and whatever. And then it was Chicago, but New York's was a little thinner. Not that that's a judgment, but at the time, you know, Philly was like the one.
Hmm.
Now, some of what is there, you retrospect probably what we didn't get, because it's too much of an albatross around your neck to have too many, you know, fine details that everybody can now point out as saying that's what's holding it, you know, progress. But one of the chief examples of that is seniority as regards to not as much layoffs even as transfer and assignment. because the language we got in Alaska sort of parallels the language we got on transfer, whether voluntary or involuntary, that whoever, it's about people competing to fill a vacancy or figuring out who gets involuntarily transferred or even who gets laid off. The criteria are training experience and qualifications for the position in question being substantially equal, then seniority controls the choice. Seniority meaning seniority in the system, the district. And of course, we thought we ought to have pure seniority, and then a moment in time came when we go, boy, we're glad we didn't get that. Seriously.
Yeah. Know?
And that this thing's working out pretty well, and given the times we're in now and what's called for. And we tightened up, you know, some here and there in process and enforceability and stuff like that. And with layoffs, it's more about training experience qualifications for the, you know, in terms of what does the district need in general. But and in a layoff, it was really almost always by seniority because they knew we would fight harder for seniority to be the decision maker. But here's the other truth is that as long as the central personnel office was administering that language, seniority, vast majority of the cases, is what they use. One, probably because they knew we were more likely to grieve it, or teachers more likely to grieve it, and two, because it was easier, and they didn't know so much what was needed at the school, you know, to be more selective. Mm. What we later did is negotiate for site-based selection of people for vacancies by a committee of teachers. You know, whoever the grade level or the department that has a vacancy forms an interview panel, and they, with the principal or designee, do the interviews and make the decision. Personnel office's role becomes to recruit and provide, you know, maintain the lists and post the vacancies, and then they process the applications in the sense that somebody applies for that school, the vacancy of that school, then they send you the names. But the school makes a decision. Well, when we did not change the criteria, this is neat because the criteria didn't have to be changed. But we've changed the locus of decision making. Far less often is seniority the deciding factor because they know what they want, they know what they need. They're more likely to use the discretion the contract, in fact, gave them to look at qualifications, training, experience first. You know, but they're still obligated to use seniority if they can't show a substantial difference. Now the next problem is, you know, how do you protect against arbitrary, capricious, you know, discriminatory, whatever, by the teachers and the principal? You have to have some kind of appeal mechanism, but it can't be a traditional grievance because a grievance is filed against administration, management, and in this case, management was only one, you know, party at the table. So we created an appeal process. It's an internal appeal process. We also figured a labor arbitrator is less likely to be the person. I mean, it's not about a matter of law. It's about a matter of professional qualifications, you know, applied to a certain position, you know, and that professionals ought to review that. So we created an internal district-wide appeal panel of teachers and administrators, equal numbers. You know, we appoint teachers, and they would review the appeals and review the facts, and they could overturn the school's decision. But the roots of this go all the way back to when we tried and failed to get strict seniority and ended up with criteria that worked out pretty well. I don't know that every teacher in Cincinnati would agree. Somebody who didn't get a job might not, but I mean, I think most people would agree it's defensible. Mm-hmm. And now that it's decentralized, it's more professional. So anyway, but that was in the non-economic reopener of 81. We got the first layoff procedure. We also managed to get a dental plan during non-economic negotiations. We had no dental coverage at this time. And the way we did that was we pushed the board to go for competitive bidding of the health insurance to see if we could save money and apply it to dental coverage. They didn't want to bother themselves doing that. We had somebody, an independent insurance consultant, actually look at their current coverage and what they were paying for it and give us some, you know, notion of whether we could save money enough by competitive bidding by a dental plan. And he came back and said, well, your first problem is going to be if you change carriers, you know, there's that reserve fund that Blue Cross is going to get to keep. We go, what reserve fund? Tell me more. Oh, they had, I don't know what, $3 million? No, it was like $7 million. What's the term the insurance companies use rather than profit? Not residuals. some term that they still use, where this is a fully insured plan, so they set a premium, probably inflated, but they set a premium based on, you know, what they project their costs will be, claims will be, and if they don't spend it, it goes into a reserve account that's in fact kept as a reserve account for your group, but the money belongs to Blue Cross. You're not going to get it back. You know, if it doesn't get used, they keep it. I don't know, after some period of time. So we had to crack, we knew we had to crack that you know, reserve fund, which they don't have to legally give back. So what we did is we went out and rounded up bids on a dental plan. Mm-hmm. And we said, this is what the dental plan will cost. That can be easily paid for the rest of this 3-year agreement out of the reserve fund that Blue Cross has. And Blue Cross said, we ain't giving up that. Now the reserve fund belongs to us. So we went public with it. You know, right. They've been overcharging the district. The district hasn't used competitive bidding, and they're getting overcharged. And that money should be freed up so that teachers can have dental coverage. And we got it. You know, but it took, and I learned a lot from that in terms of future bargaining. We got a little bit more sophisticated that when it comes to bargaining benefits, we get on the same side of the table with the district, and you know, try to squeeze the health insurance and the providers. So I can't remember what else we got. We got a few, you know, some other language stuff, but those are the two big, two biggies in that. But meantime, what's happening is we're getting ourselves, allowing ourselves to get embroiled within the local in social issues and political issues, and there was, because there was a lot of underlying tension still in the district and in the community about underrepresentation of minority teachers feeling the brunt of these racial balance transfers. Push for affirmative action and hiring. There's still, the DSEG suit is still not settled. So that's a big underlying tension. And I would say me and some of my closest supporters got wanting to do the right thing and be on the right side of these issues and knowing that we needed community support to be, have the strength to deal with the power structure in the community as represented by the school board. Were a little overzealous in pursuing these issues, or didn't pursue them in a way that was, you know, altogether unifying. And there was some very specific thing that came down to that had to be voted on, where we supported some kind of affirmative action plan that then our adversaries from the prior elections, or adversaries within the union, or people who were still licking their wounds from, you know, the previous election, were able to jump on and try to convince people that we were actually talking about displacing white teachers in order to hire black teachers, which, of course, okay. we weren't that stupid. But we were guilty of getting, you know, an overdose of political correctness and trying to show what great white liberals we were, you know. And it was, you know, we were trying to do the right thing. It was the best of intentions. And some of it was tactical, knowing that we needed, not tactical, but strategic, we needed community support. In order to counter the power of the that we confronted across the table, which was the ruling class of the city. But anyway, we didn't handle it altogether well. So things got polarized, and the prior president smelled his opportunity. So he put together a slate called the Roger Stevens Victory Party. With names, as I mentioned, with much more well-known names, even just plain names, than folks that were on the young hard worker types that were on my slate. And they won. I beat him, and they won all the other offices. I think the executive board was pretty evenly balanced, because most of the area coordinators that were on the board at that time, you know, were still on the board, were my, you know, younger folks that had been the area coordinators during the strike, or people much like them. So I could deal with the board, but the officers were a problem. but what happened is when their guy didn't, it didn't stay a problem for long, because when their guy didn't win, and this kind of tells you a lot about what faction of the union they were representing, they didn't really want to do the work. Some of them had been recruited to office told they wouldn't have to do the work, that somebody else was actually going to do the work, like the treasurer. They ran a black female who was very attractive and well-known, and, you know, an long activist, not a lightweight, but she didn't know how to be treasurer. They told her, you know, white male dude who's the grievance guy, you know, under the old regime, and he was still grievance chair when I was there, when I became elected, and was very confident that he was actually going to do the books. Don't worry. And she said, okay. And you know, other people, God knows what their expectations were. But the point is, the first vice president and the recording secretary didn't last 6 months. One of them became a principal, and both later became principals, not too far down the road. But they basically resigned and said, I don't want to do it. So I was able to get, you know, my folks in. And the treasurer, I just decided I wasn't going to let them, you know, play her. So meanwhile, the point is, though, the guy that was going to do the books for her isn't around anymore, right? So I just decided we were going to work with her. She was going to be the treasurer. She was really going to be the treasurer, and I wasn't going to, you know, we wanted to have good, you know, black officers and leaders anyway, and I wasn't going to let them play her that way. I was going to make her, you know, I was going to get her on my team. We did. We became long, long allies and friends, and she did, you know, did fine. So basically, by the end of the first year, if not before, we were politically, you know, fine, back in a strong position. But it was a little nasty fight there for a while.
So this is when you start, once everything's solidified, your union's now more of a solidarity, everybody. Is this when you start realizing that contract negotiations need to go into more professional development and that stuff?
Yeah, that combination of things led to that. First of all, I told you this, in 81 when the association could have challenged, they weren't able to get, you know, even the 30%. But in 84, they did. And it was largely, AFT came in, was very helpful. I think they did actually then the first real professional polling of a local membership in relation to sort of organizing and, you know, bargaining representation. I believe that that's what it was, and it was not cheap in 1984 dollars. It was expensive. It was Peter Hart. Mm-hmm. Because what we were trying to find out is, why were they getting any traction at all after all these economic gains? And, you know, what did we have to do to shut them down once and for all? And, you know, of course, you have to have a theory. You have to have things to test. You have to know what you have to at least have some hypotheses if you're going to have a good poll, in my experience, right? You have to kind of test some things. And we did. And so if you, it goes back to, remember I talked about that first set of bargaining proposals and we developed in late 76. It was like this whole, you know, manual for transforming the school system. Well, we hadn't really been able to get much of that except for the economic and sort of basic working condition rights and stuff. But teacher voice, you know, or even really improve working conditions in terms of class size or numbers of teaching periods or numbers of different course assignments. We hadn't made much progress on that because that stuff's expensive, you know. And plus, they didn't want to put those things in the contract if they didn't have to. I mean, their attitude was very clear from day one. If we have to bargain, we're going to keep it to wages and hours and, you know, the most narrowly defined working conditions. And so that no matter what idealism you start with, if you take only a traditional approach to bargaining, you're going to get funneled in that direction. Mm-hmm. And not meet people's expectations on the other, not even necessarily exotic reform issues, but just having a voice in day-to-day running the school, curriculum, and working conditions, literally workloads, you know, we hadn't really made a dent on. So that was my hypothesis, and that the poll kind of bore that out. And that, you know, we had to deliver on those kinds of things. Now the dilemma is also, despite the one-day strike that was successful under those, you know, that real pressure cooker circumstance, the strike reluctance on the part of the teachers was very high, and no secret. You know, if I knew it, it was loud and clear to me. It was loud and clear to the principals who filtered up to the top bosses. So on the one hand, they're telling us, you know, they want a whole bunch of things that I know from having been at the table and been, you know, been out there, that they weren't likely to get without a strike. We're going to get without a strike. But combined with, they don't want a strike. Because I also have the experience by now of calling, well, during their economic reopeners that the previous president had when I was a director of organization and couldn't get anything, calling, you know, strike authorization votes during the non-economic reopener, and that dragged on. you couldn't even get, they would vote with their feet. They ain't coming to the meeting. Mm-hmm. They ain't going to give you any encouragement to think they might, you know, consider strikes. They just don't even come to the meeting. And then you know right there physically in the room, you ain't got it. You know, you ain't got shit based on the numbers that even showed up. They didn't show up to vote no, you know. Because they know if they showed up, we'd be putting in the paper, 2,000 teachers came to, you know, consider a strike authorization vote. So they ain't done. So the point is, it was somewhat necessity is the mother of invention. To win that Barney election, we simply articulated what the poll said. You know, that this is, we know this is what teachers want, and this is what we're pledged to. We've made huge economic gains. Now the next phase is we're going to go after these things. We've proven we can get the jet. You know, we're the effective. You know, so much more effective than the association of bargaining. And here's the agenda for the next round. Well, I think they, remember, they also got, there was a little bit of a false scare because they got the signatures the same way we got them three times by telling people, this doesn't necessarily mean you support us being the bargaining agent, it's just a fair and democratic thing to do to have an election. We'd had 1, 2, 3, 4. So how hard is it to get people to say, well, it's time for an election again, we do this every few years, you know, but we need to submit signatures to get an election, and that's the only fair thing to do. That's how they get, you know, it's not hard to get the signatures. But we took it seriously nonetheless, but we beat the crap out of them. It was like 70%. It was like 69.5%.
Wow.
So that really was the end of them. I mean, they never came back after that. They faded away fairly fast. We didn't get a fair share, but we had to build our membership up before we could get a fair share. By this time, by the way, at 84, we get a bargaining law with the possibility of negotiating, you know, fair share in a really broad scope of bargaining. That's its best feature, and the right to strike. So we are
in the state of Ohio. Bargaining.
We're now in a stronger position following that Barney election in '83. We're in a stronger position going into. It'll be the first contract negotiated under that new law. Hmm. You know what though? What I don't remember thinking at the time is, oh, everything's changed. We got this law because really, we still felt like what we're going to get is based on our strength. You know, politically as well as internally and. You know, we can get whatever we can get. We're used to the climate where what you can get is how much pressure you can, depending on how much pressure you can put on the employer. So it didn't see, I think in retrospect, I understand more how the legal framework, you know, helped, but it was so new that nobody had a real clear expectations of what it would mean. Anyway, so the next thing, this is where we now start to formulate a new strategy for achieving these professional goals, including just plain old improvement in working conditions. And do take a new direction in terms of both the issues that we're putting on the table and prioritizing, and also the tactics, you know, that we're going to use to be successful in getting those things negotiated. Now, this is the same time where A Nation at Risk comes out in '83, and so it's education reform breaks out, but in the most negative anti-teacher way initially, right? The first phase of this modern education reform debate or movement was, you know, very negative toward teachers. Actually, I'll never forget the symbol of that to me of that period was a Newsweek magazine cover with Why Johnny Can't Read, and it shows a teacher sitting in the corner with a dunce cap on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all teacher backs. This was Reagan, you know, it was Reagan. It was very similar to now. And I guess that era almost seems benign by comparison to now, but. As far as what they were, the drumbeat they were trying to get going against teachers and unions, Pat Coe, you know, was all that. So then comes along some help a couple years later. You get the Carnegie Report, which at least creates another strand of the education reform debate of teacher professionalism and raising the quality and the standards for getting into teaching, and that's the answer. And we certainly picked up on that, you know, big time. So I mean, AFT picked up on that big time. So we were getting a lot of encouragement, you know, from Shanker and others to pursue issues in a new way. Even taking old issues like class size and putting it in the new context of it's about the kids, it's not a working condition issue. So we tried to get those things out of our vocabulary and never call class size, you know, a working condition,
mm-hmm.
but a teaching and learning condition or an educational quality improvement. Or, you know, we just try to change our language on some of the old demands, but also bring in some new issues. So you're looking for opportunities too. You're looking for how to take these big themes and translate them into specific issues that you can both rally your members around, but that also resonate with the public, that also, you know, the public can support.
Can I go back to Nation Risk?
Mm-hmm.
Your reaction, and I guess your local, was this teacher bashing. And then,
not so much the report itself, is that the all the rhetoric and around education reform and what it would mean to have education reform, and it meant, you know, cracking down on these teachers. But see, we also, I was fully on board with Shanker's approach to it, which is embrace the need for reform and then start trying to change the term